Hot Take is brought to you by Smile Actives. Are you self-conscious about your smile due to stains? Are your teeth aging you? Beverages like coffee and wine stain your teeth over time. So what can you do to brighten your smile? Well, you should give Smile Actives a try. Smile Actives is safe, effective, easy to use, and will keep you smiling proudly. If you're anything like me, you probably drink, I don't know, maybe a whole pot of coffee every morning, and then maybe you go out in the afternoon and get an iced coffee. I don't know. I don't know your life. I just know mine. And yeah, that stuff starts to add up over time. 97% of Smile Actives users in a clinical trial reported up to 6 shades whiter on average, all within 30 days. Have you ever wished that you had a whiter and brighter smile? Well, before you visit a dentist, you should know that their whitening treatments can be very expensive. And it's not just the price. You also have to book the appointment and schedule time away from work or family to sit in a dentist's office or chair while undergoing the procedure. It's a hassle. Fortunately, now you can try Smile Actives at home or anywhere, anytime. Smile Actives offer a safe and affordable alternative to those expensive whitening procedures. Simply add Smile Actives Pro Whitening Gel to your regular toothpaste, so no change to your routine, no extra time, yet people will start commenting on your whiter, brighter smile in just days. And even if they don't, so what? It's your smile. Get your own validation from within yourself. Smile Actives is the whitening boost your favorite toothpaste needs to give you the smile you deserve. Visit smileactives.com/hot today to receive our special buy one, get one free offer, plus free shipping and handling. That's smileactives.com/hot. Cricut is bringing our patented no bullshit conversations to the airwaves for the very first time with Cricut Radio. Every weekend in the lead up to the midterms elections on SiriusXM Progress and on the SiriusXM app. It's a new way to listen to the same Cricut content you love. Join our lineup of podcast hosts, candidates, experts, and more, including Hot Take, as we break down all the issues that matter this November, dive into the conversation shaping our current political climate, and get the only 100% correct opinions in politics. You don't want to miss this. Subscribe now and get up to 4 months of SiriusXM. See offer details at SiriusXM.com/Cricut. Hey, hotcakes. Welcome to Hot Take. I'm Mariana Youth-Hegler.
And I'm Sarah Snaith, an investigative journalist filling in for Amy Westervelt.
And we are so happy to have you. Sarah is both an investigative journalist and an alligator expert. She doesn't like to brag about that last part. Unfortunately, Amy had to miss this week's recording, and we will miss her, but we're always happy to have you here, Sarah. Thank you so much.
Thanks for having me.
This week, we're going to be talking about a word you probably hear a lot of if you've been listening to climate conversations, frontline communities.
That's right. And just a refresher, frontline communities are those communities that suffer the worst impacts of climate change. These communities are more often Black and brown communities.
The term frontline communities can sometimes be used interchangeably with fence line communities, but those are actually different things. Fence line communities specifically refers to communities that are located near fossil fuel infrastructure, often literally across a fence. So while fence line communities are frontline communities, all frontline communities are not necessarily fence line communities.
That's right. But even for folks who know what frontline communities are, by definition, we're not exactly good at talking about them. And the media still regularly ignores them or silences them until it's way, way too late.
Right. And that's why I'm glad we're going to be taking this deep dive with the Hot Take champion, Drew Cosley. Perfect. Drew Cosley is one of our all-time favorite people to talk to about so many things, which is why they're the first person to come on Hot Take not once, not twice, but now 3 times.
I remember those episodes with Drew. They were so great. I can't wait to talk to them again.
And actually, you're not that far behind Drew, because now this is your second time on Hot Take. Drew came on in 2020 to talk about the importance of local journalism, and then again in 2021 to talk about prison abolition. And we're really excited to talk to them again, so I think it's time.
It's time to talk about climate.
Today's Today's episode is sponsored by Ravensburger Puzzles. I don't think I've ever been so excited about an advertiser in my life because, yes, I am a giant puzzle nerd. And Ravensburger makes the best puzzles, as anyone who loves puzzles will tell you. I live in a place where we actually get pretty frequent power outages. And when we do, I like to break out a puzzle. It's also a fun way to keep my kids off of their screens and do something sort of calm and meditative together. It's very satisfying when you snap that last piece into place. If you are looking for a calm and mindful exercise, I highly recommend checking out Ravensburger. Regardless of your preferences or skill level, you'll find a jigsaw puzzle that suits you perfectly thanks to the wide range of imagery, themes, and piece counts available. You can start small with a pretty straightforward puzzle and work your way up to over 40,000 pieces. Are you up for the challenge? Shop Ravensburger on Amazon today. This holiday season, get a gift for yourself too, and keep it simple. I gave myself the gift of a better, more convenient laundry experience. I know, laundry doesn't sound like a gift, but honestly, EarthBreeze just makes it so much easier. Think about how you actually do laundry. You have to work out how much detergent to pour, lift that big plastic jug, hope the goo doesn't get everywhere. It's annoying. But EarthBreeze Eco Sheets look like nothing I've ever seen in the detergent aisle. It's like a dryer sheet kind of, but it's the detergent and you throw it in and then that's it. There's no measuring, no nothing. It works in hot and cold. It's also dermatologist tested, hypoallergenic, and free of bleach and dyes. And it fights everyday stains and odors. You get a powerful clean, but you don't have to deal with all that packaging. Right now, my listeners can get started with EarthBreeze and save 40%, 40%. Go to earthbreeze.com/drilled. That's earthbreeze.com/drilled for 40% off your subscription. earthbreeze.com/drilled.
Hi, Drew. How are you doing? How's life at the Associated Press?
Oh, I'm doing well. You know, it's the we've reached the end of disaster season, which I have dubbed the busiest time of year. I feel like all these other beats sort of rest during the summer, you know, like education, business, slow down, entertainment even slows down. But in the environmental beat, that's when things pop off. But who knows, maybe things will keep popping off or maybe they'll be over. So, you know, things are good. Just relaxing.
Drew, I have a wooden table in front of me and I'm knocking on it. Because to say a disaster season is over in this climate is kind of crazy.
In this economy? In this political right? In this political economy?
On this heating globe?
Yeah. Yeah. In this atmosphere, even. So I hope you're right. I really do. Because we could use a break. But one of the last times you and I talked, it was because you were in my home state reporting on the Jackson water crisis. So the thing I'm dying to know is, did you make it to my aunt's restaurant?
I didn't. I'm sorry. You know, I had stopped eating meat again, and I was like undecided of whether or not I was going to eat fish. But I didn't want to eat fish until I had decided, you know, because like meat is so good. I didn't want it to sway my opinion on whether or not I should eat meat. And what types of meat. And I didn't go. And I was really busy. I'm sorry, boo.
That's okay. I mean, I understand. And look, if you were, you know, on the fence and tempted by meat, that was not a great environment for you to be on. So you probably made the best.
Yeah.
Probably made a better choice.
Yeah.
Yeah. Personally, I was pescatarian until my neighbor down the street started cooking for us. And then I stopped. I started eating meat there. I mean, I feel like that's what's going to happen when you live in New Orleans, you know, like the food's too good.
I mean, I've been vegan and I live in New Orleans.
That's true. That's true.
I'm good. I'm good.
So, Drew, you were in Jackson at a particularly high stakes moment, though, when the city had no running water and reporters were flooding into the city from all over and residents were understandably on edge. I know I saw a lot of folks on Twitter talking about reporters coming to them in not so respectful ways. How was it for you navigating that and getting the story right?
Yeah, so I should say, like, yeah, thanks for asking that. I think, like, I went, actually, when I got there, it was, I recognized that it was after the first round of media coverage of what was going on in Jackson, right? And so, I knew that people would be wary and weary. And so I kind of wanted to take, I mean, whenever I approach people who have gone through something that I recognize as traumatic, if I'm being honest, right? Like losing water completely, like, and not being able to like do the things that are like normally the things you do in life with a very basic necessity, to me qualifies as a trauma. You know, I'm going to go and try to like talk to them with the understanding that maybe they don't want to talk, right? And that I'm not entitled to their story, you know? So that, you know, it was just like, that's how I kind of try to go into all of the stories that I write about in terms of environmental climate justice. I feel like a lot of times we think as journalists, because I'm saying, well, we as like you and I say, as people who work the beat, and then like, Mary, you get to have some distance from this sort of this ethos of like, I'm doing the important work, right? Like I am doing something that's going to hopefully result in a net benefit for society and for the people I cover. And so because of that, I really need your story in order to do that good, right? And that might be the case. I don't know. But I think that what people can, I think people can sense when you feel that you are entitled to their story and that you're not really there to like try to connect with them on a human level, regardless of like what the end product is, you know? And I try my best to not like go in with that attitude. So that's kind of how I was approaching it.
Yeah. So you don't just like grab a microphone and shove it in people's face and tell them like, tell me your story or else.
Well, you know, it's so funny that you say that because I did start my career in environmental journalism doing just that. I was a sports reporter, as people who might have heard me on this podcast before know, when I started out. But my first taste of environmental reporting came when I was on an alternative spring break trip with Howard University when I was an undergrad. And I worked for the school paper, and I thought I was like writing about, I wasn't on the sports beat when I was in the school paper. And so I thought maybe it was a campus activity that we were going down there to do, to volunteer, right, with people's recovery and relief efforts. And so I wanted to cover it, and it seemed like an important story. And I had that attitude, right? Of like, I'm coming down to save everybody with the one story that's going to change everything, right? And we were on the bus. We had just gotten pulled into, we were sort of taking, I think we were taking like a tour of New Orleans. And some of like the volunteer work we were going to do was going to be based in the lower Ninth Ward. And so we pulled up to the lower, like to like, I think it was like some busy street, like next to, like right on the outside of where the lower Ninth Ward starts. And there was a guy who had like a protest, like a one person protest. And he had a sign, and I don't remember what the sign said. I actually have a picture of this whole thing. This whole moment, which is pretty embarrassing and, you know, affirming that I shouldn't act like this way ever again in my journalism career. We piled out of the bus, and a few people walked up to him, you know, and I don't know what their motives and things were. They weren't there as journalists, though, as sort of this dual role that I was there as. But I rushed up to him with my voice recorder in one hand and my in my pad, my reporter's notebook in the other, and I shoved my recorder in his face and I asked him some question about what it was like to live in the lower Ninth Ward or live in New Orleans and post-Katrina New Orleans. And he completely ignored me, you know, which he should have. Mm-hmm. I might have completely ignored him. Like, right. Like if I was in his situation, like I know I have like me, Drew, like the real person. I am extremely shy around new people, you know, like
you are.
Yes, I'm so like if like, you know, like with you and I, Mary, like we had some exchanges online, right? Before we started like talking about stuff. But like if I had just like walked up, if we were in the same room and I had never met you before, I would be extremely shy, right? And so like,
oh wow,
I
wouldn't expect that.
Yeah, well, a lot of people don't, but this is like a very long story why I'm shy that I won't get into. But it only takes me a little bit of warming up to people, and then I'm a little more outgoing. But when it's new people that I've never met before, I'm very shy. And so I think about like, well, what was this guy's experience of like some random like 20-something just running up in his face with all these other little undergrad snots like surrounding him, like asking him questions about fucking this like immense trauma that he was like having a one person protest over, you know, like, and like, of course he ignored me. And I felt that, you know, I'm sensitive. I felt him ignore me. And it was very informative for sort of that whole experience, which was really like a very formative experience for me in terms of how I approach environmental justice reporting. And even like inspired me to like, you know, that was sort of the first time that I had gotten a taste of doing this type of work. So yeah, it's always stuck with me that like, I'm not entitled to anyone's story. No one owes me their story. Like we, like journalists have a, you know, we have the First Amendment that allows us like freedom of press, but it doesn't give us entitlement to someone's story and like most intimate details and like their like feelings, you know, like we kind of have to earn that through the way that we like approach people. So I did actually at one point in my career did shove a microphone in someone's face, but I try not to do that anymore.
Oh wow. So getting back to the Jackson water crisis, I want to take a moment to remind the audience that the Jackson water crisis is very much not over. And even at the time, it wasn't new. You might remember it burst onto the national scene back in 2021 with the winter freeze. It's a chronic crisis and it goes much further than Jackson. I've talked on this show before about how it affects the entire state, and the rural communities rarely get any type of attention, even though it's just as much a crisis there. The water crisis across the whole state is chronic, but it only gets attention at acute flashpoints. And that seems to be a problem for frontline communities across the board. Drew, how do you hold that tension as a national reporter? When you're going into a frontline community, how do you remain mindful of the chronic crisis while focusing on the acute crisis? And do you try to follow the stories after you leave?
Yeah, I mean, I feel really fortunate that I work for an organization that has reporters in a lot of different places, right? So I, like, with what's going on in Jackson, there are two awesome reporters, Emily Waxter Pettis and I can't remember the guy's last name right now, Michael, whose last name who was a very gracious host, and I'm sorry, I can't remember your last name right now. They're the ones that cover Jackson on a day-to-day basis. You know, I was brought down there because there were some like racial angles that like I have, you know, I'm informed about how systemic racism, it results in environmental harm, you know, and they wanted me to write that story. But if they like wanted me to write, like there are some things that I heard when I was down there about research that citizens are going to do into tracking water at the tap and understanding that, yeah, it's a chronic issue. If there's other stories for me to write that like they can't handle, which it's probably hard to make happen because they're great reporters. So I don't know if anyone's ever told you about a tickler file on this. Have I ever said tickler file? Sarah knows what a tickler file is, probably.
Can I guess what a tickler file is?
Sure, yes.
I assume it's probably like a enemies list of people who are extremely ticklish. like you just want to, you're plotting how to sneak up on them at the most embarrassing moment and tickle them until they surrender.
Yeah, no, it's, that's, no. I would be on that list, by the way. I'm very ticklish.
How many, are you with somebody's enemy, though?
Oh, I'm probably a lot of people's enemy, but that's okay. Yeah, you're the one that's got hella enemies. That's the sidebar.
I'm a Scorpio.
What does that mean?
I'm a Scorpio. I'm allowed to have enemies.
Well, I'm a Leo, so I'm also allowed to have enemies, you know? Because, you know, I'm the star, baby. Anyways,
y'all
I'm just
don't
kidding.
Hold grudges.
We don't hold grudges, but we do have haters. You know what I'm saying? Okay, so yeah, so a tickler file is like a file of your like story, of like stories and story ideas, right? So I have like a tickler file of stories that I've done, stories I want to do, stories that are like harebrained ideas, you know, that I come up with at like 2 a.m. and maybe need more development and research. And like, so I have a tickler file of like all the places that I've been or written about, and I can like keep track of what's going on, like major developments. But I don't know, like I'm sort of an at-large reporter, so I don't really get to like, I don't have the same function as a local reporter, right? Like I think my, where I'm at right now is there's a job of amplification. And I think what, you know, to talk about like what you were in like in record, right? Like the Associated Press is like a news outlet of record, you know? So it's important that there's a record that there was like systemic harm that fell along racial and class lines that resulted in like environmental inequity, right? Those are sort of my functions, right? I think. And less so sort of like the day-to-day coverage of like what a beat reporter would do. But to get at like the other part of your question, I think about bringing like understanding like the chronic issue and like bringing that out in the report is like, you know, you just, I don't try to conceive any of my stories as I'm the first person that learned about this, you know, like I come from hip hop, you know, and there's a famous Nas line, no idea is original. You know, there's nothing new under the sun. Mm-hmm. And that's like that's a paraphrase of a quote, of a famous quote itself. Right. And so like, mm-hmm. When I come down and I'm reporting, like I have to do a bunch of background research to like know what's happened before, what's been written about before. And like, don't necessarily need to give my sources a book report, but like can like let them know that I understand that there is a chronic issue. And then like, how have you been experiencing this since before we got here is usually a question I ask, yeah. You know, especially with things like with Jackson, like, you know, it's just like with Flint, like that there were people in the community for like a decade or more, like raising alarm bells. You just, I don't know. You don't act like, I just don't act like this is sort of the event. I know that I'm getting sent down there because there's like acute attention in my editors and like management are like seeing that they want to put resources to this. But like me, myself, the person trying to connect with sources, like, you know, we have to have this understanding. Like I have to like communicate this understanding to them that like this is not new. Yeah.
Sarah, I know you do reporting trips as well. How do you think about these things as you try to make inroads with new communities?
Yeah, I love what Drew's saying. I love so many things that he's saying about, first off, just like letting people off the hook, you know, to like, if they don't want to talk right now, if they feel like that's going to do them more harm, then I don't push the issue, you know, just walk away. That's fine. You know, because some people do feel like talking helps them and they feel that's cathartic, but other people don't. And like, you should let people be themselves in that moment. And another thing I was just thinking about was like being curious, like not trying to assign your own context to what people tell you. So, another thing that Drew just mentioned was about, doing your research, you know, before you go into a community. One thing I've come across, though, is like when I do my research, the research, the quote unquote research, often involves reading other news articles or like news clippings of that. So that's kind of like an interpretation of what the community has experienced. That's not exactly necessarily in the same words as the community would use, you know? So like, I think take those news articles sometimes with a grain of salt, like whose perspective is that really coming from? And maybe the community doesn't like the way that they've been portrayed in the past. So like be open to that. And sometimes even asking the question, what have people gotten wrong in the past, is a good way to like let people help set the narrative straight. And then I think that another thing that I just wish I would have known a lot earlier is that it's okay to offer a hand if people need help. Like if someone's in the middle of doing something and you're asking them, you know, questions, it's okay to just like jump in there and help them do that thing. That's a really good way to like bond with people too and show that you don't think of yourself in some regard that you can't get your hands dirty or like you can't, you know, be there helping and be a human first, you know?
Yeah, I've actually kind of always wondered how journalists handle that. Like if you're reporting in the immediate wake of a, like, let's say a hurricane or a fire, and somebody's like needing diapers or something like that. Like, I know there's a tension around paying your sources, but how do you not give in a moment like that? I know Amy's talked about that before. But I wonder how y'all hold it.
Yeah, it's difficult. I mean, it happened while I was down there. There were these guys who were like unloading a water truck, like
in Jackson.
Yeah, and they were like, "Can you help?" And I was like, "I'm not really supposed to." And you know, I mean, I ended up helping some, but it's difficult, honestly. And I'm grateful for what you're saying, Sarah, because I think that we should be able to like actually be human and help our sources. Like, and I think there's a line, you know, I think there's some sort of common sense line between like paying sources, right? Like favor for like access and like just like being a human, you know?
Absolutely.
And, you know, I don't know. It's definitely like, I'll probably stop talking after I say this because it's like, you know, my outlet isn't necessarily like, they have like very old sort of like traditional ideas about that sort of intersection. And I don't know, maybe they need to be revisited. Yeah. Who knows?
Yeah. Drew, guess what?
What?
Chicken butt. No? Nobody laughed at that? That was funny. I am so disappointed in
yourself? Wow.
Okay, first of fucking all.
Damn, came on camera. Came on camera. Hey, what's
are
up?
Are we fighting? Are we fighting?
No, I just was playing.
I feel like you're coming from a neck.
Damn. Your chicken neck.
So, Drew, where do sheep go on vacation?
Oh, thank you so much. I'm so glad we're doing jokes.
I did a joke a minute ago.
Oh, that was a catch it. It was that over was your a head. Joke?
Yeah, that was over your head. All
right. That was okay. That was over my head. Where do sheep go on vacation? Shirhamas. I don't know. The shore. The shore?
Oh my gosh, you were so close. They go to the Bahamas.
Whoa, I was really close. Fuck.
I feel like you get honorary air horn. Going to ads. Hot Take is brought to you by Lomi. If you've ever tried composting at home, you might know that it's a little bit of an art. I once failed really badly at composting, and long story short, I wound up having to empty my composting bin full of worms underneath a bridge in the winter. Yeah. it got dark. But then I got a Lomi. Lomi allows me to turn my food scraps into dirt with the push of a button. Lomi is a countertop electric composter that turns scraps into dirt in under 4 hours. I know that sounds not very believable, but trust me, it happens. And there's no smell when it runs, and it's really quiet. I'm saying this from experience. And I got my Lomi at the actual perfect time because I've gotten really into plants lately. So couldn't have been better. Thanks to Lomi, I have way less garbage each week. Since I got my Lomi, I throw out way less garbage. That means it's not going to landfills and producing methane. Instead, I turn my waste into nutrient-rich dirt that I can use to feed my plants. Lomi is super easy to use. It has like 3 settings, and I just picked the simplest one because that's the one it came set to. And it's great. If you want to start making a positive environmental impact or just make cleanup after dinner that much easier, Lomi is perfect for you. Head to lomi.com/hot to use the promo code HOT to get $50 off your Lomi. That's $50 off when you head to lomi.com/hot and use promo code HOT at checkout. Food waste is gross. Lomi is your solution. You'll want to move quickly as they're over 80% sold out for October. That's Lomi, lomi.com/hot. Hot Take is brought to you by Cozy Earth. Cozy Earth sheets are made from premium 100% viscose from bamboo, which means they're super soft, lightweight, and temperature regulating, so you'll sleep more comfortably year round. I love my Cozy Earth sheets. They feel like sleeping on butter, which I know that might sound weird, but just trust me, it feels really good. And you fall asleep. I fall asleep so much faster when I'm sleeping on them. Cozy Earth products are so amazing. They have been featured in Oprah's Favorite Things 4 years in a row. They also offer a 100-night sleep guarantee, which means you have up to 100 nights to sleep on it. Wash it. Try it out. If you're not completely in love, just send it back for a full refund. And Cozy Earth offers a 10-year warranty. When is the last time you heard that kind of warranty for sheets? Cozy Earth's bedding, towels, and clothing are all warranted against pilling, discoloration, and shredding. You can rest assured any defects are covered and replaced immediately. Plus, they're made out of bamboo, so pretty sustainable stuff here. Whether it's their best-selling luxury sheets, ultra-comfortable loungewear collection, or new bath collection, you'll absolutely love shopping at Cozy Earth. Our audience can save 35% on Cozy Earth. Get cozy now. Go to CozyEarth.com/hot and save 35%, all backed by a 100-night sleep guarantee. That's CozyEarth.com/HOT. Exciting news. Pod Save America dropped a bonus episode last week featuring an interview with former President Barack Obama, and they discussed everything from the importance of the upcoming midterms to what's going on in Iran. We promise you don't want to miss this. Listen to the conversation in the Pod Save America feed wherever you get your podcasts.
Yeah, one thing we've been hearing a lot about in recent years, and not a moment too soon, is trauma-informed reporting. And I know personally, I don't think I've ever had any formal training for this. I literally remember a moment at my first newspaper job when I was interviewing a victim of a violent crime, and I was literally like Googling on Pointer how to talk to a person who's the victim of a violent crime as I was talking to this person. So Drew, I'm wondering if you've gotten any training in this area and have any tips.
The short answer is no, right? Like, I haven't gotten any, like if there was a certification, right? Like taking a trauma-informed reporting class. I've never done that. I'm a survivor of trauma. I have chronic and complex PTSD. And I come from people that have experienced lots of trauma in multiple ways, right? Like, I'm Black, I'm queer, I'm disabled. And I grew up with some level of poverty. And I think that just like how like those things can inform my report in some ways, in terms of identity, I guess also they can inform my report in terms of identity as being like a trauma survivor and understanding that like understanding, like having contact with people who have gone through trauma. Yeah, it's a very important designation to be trauma informed, I think, right? And one that shouldn't be taken lightly. So I won't say that I've gotten any training in doing it, but I have a lot of experience thinking about it and talking about it with people in some inside the industry and some outside, just people who I know, in some of the communities mm-hmm. that I'm in. And I think that it's something that like we should all have, period. Journalists or not, like we are all like, if you just take the most recent, like the most recent example that is very overarching, which is COVID, right? A lot of the conversation and that people had about that experience was that it was a shared trauma, right? It's collective trauma. And I think like we can all benefit from some level of training on how to like approach each other, period, regardless of whether or not we're trying to get a quote, you know, when it comes to like being trauma informed. So I would love if there was actually some training to take. I'd sign up for that shit yesterday. And I think it's incredibly important that we have that understanding that people have experienced some really heavy shit mm-hmm. and that we want to be careful not to re-traumatize people to like, I think it's such a gift when people like share with me, period. Right. And they're vulnerable. I just try to, and that's period. That's inside and outside of my work. And I try to take that with me into my work. But yeah, I would love to like be trained by some fucking psychologists, right? Some therapists on like how to talk to mm-hmm. people who've like, you know, experienced trauma. I'd love to do that.
Yeah. One thing I wonder about is in terms of trauma-informed reporting, so like there's the way that you approach, you know, your hopeful sources, but also there's the trauma you take with you after those conversations and after those stories. And to go from like, especially for climate reporters, I could imagine mm-hmm. going from like disaster to disaster to disaster. That's a lot to hold for you as a person, even if you weren't the person who experienced the hurricane. And I know for you, Sarah, based in New Orleans, like you have experienced the hurricane yourself. Drew, when you're based in the Bay, like you were breathing that air just like everybody else during fire season. So like how do you hold that as journalists?
Can Sarah answer that question first? because I live in an area that is not as disaster prone right now. And I'm really curious how you, as somebody who's like more so in the trenches than I am, how you do that, like how you handle that.
Well, yeah, I guess one thing I was talking to someone about this the other day. One thing I think I took away from Hurricane Ida specifically was just how the things that are reported as like, you know, as we're reporting, we're always looking for, you know, there's a tendency to look for the worst example, you know, a death, somebody who is seriously injured, you know, something like that. You're looking for something that's outwardly shows the impacts of these events in a way that really captures the worst of it. But I think what's missing though, and what I experienced was just also how it can impact you in seemingly small ways, but like really get under your skin, you know, like the way like you can't, during Hurricane Ida, like I came back to I evacuated to Mississippi. And then I came back, and on my way back, I was trying to get gas, and the prices of the gas were so high, you couldn't even get them. And some of the lines were like hours and hours long, and it was just impossible to like get, you know, back to the city. Then I got back into the city, and like my water had been, a tree fell down in my front yard. And so my water line had been pulled out and I had no water. And then I was like, I felt just like a disappointment, you know, because I thought like, I want to be telling my community's story and I want to do it well, but I can't even do it very well because I don't even have electricity. I don't have the best internet, like I'm not getting out the stories fast enough. And it feels like those things just weigh on you, you know, in a way that is long-term too. You know, it doesn't just go away when the storm happens, or when the storm's over either. Like it sticks with you, and it, you know, they say that people who are the children of like people who've experienced violence, that they themselves like take that violence with them. Like it's in their, like DNA, basically. And I feel like the same thing could probably be said of like people who experience multiple hurricanes. Like, I just think it must stick with you, you know, because it stuck. Mm-hmm. The one when I went through that was really bad. It really stuck with me, you know?
Yeah.
Yeah. Wow.
Yeah.
Thank you for sharing that, Sarah. Yeah. I mean, I feel that. Yeah. I don't know. I'm thinking now about personal experience and like, it's like, is this a way in which I benefited from growing up in a dysfunctional household, right? Like, where, like, I have some level of, like, training and rhythm around, like, is the shit going to hit the fan today? Or is it going to hit the fan next week, mm-hmm. right? But it's definitely going to hit the fan. I just, like, do the same things that, I don't know, man. I got a therapist, you know, I pray, I meditate, I drink water, mm-hmm. I try to feed myself as well as possible. And it's so, I vibe with Sarah when it's like, I had that experience a couple times when I was living in the Bay and I was writing about wildfires while experiencing like having to like be in the house, like having a shelter in place because I lived in the Bay between 2017 and 2020, like late 2020, basically. And like, it happened several times, right? While I was living there, mm-hmm. where it was like so much smoke outside that the local authorities were selling us this shelter in place. And like, I was still like reporting, you know? And yeah, that feeling of like being sort of part of the community that's being impacted by whatever it is that you're trying to report on, it just makes it incredibly difficult. And then during COVID, you know, like I was like writing about research, you know, like all this COVID research and like when I worked at 1-0 and like also like was afraid of getting the virus, you know, like on a daily basis and like had all of these things like and afraid of my family members getting the virus, and like had all these things impacted, right? Like where I used to say we could get like 60% of what we wanted out of a day, you know, like we go to the grocery store, we want to get all our groceries. We come back with, you know, some food that we don't want, some toilet paper that we don't have toilet paper, shit like that. I mean, mm-hmm. I don't know. It's hard. And the tools remain the same, right? Like, to try to cope and to try to still like heal and recover and recuperate and grow. Mm-hmm. That's what I do. I just try to take care of myself as well as possible. I mean, you know, I've had situations in my career where like I didn't take care of my mental health, and my wellness, for long enough that it broke me and I couldn't do the work anymore, you know? And I recognized sort of when I was coming out of the most recent time of that like I have to be able to take care of myself so that I can help other people. So yeah, I don't know.
Yeah, that's real.
Absolutely. I think when I've done my best at this, what I've been able to do is to show joy that people have in impacted communities and vulnerable communities. And I think that's important because it shows how communities have all the ingredients to thrive when they're given the opportunity. And I wanted to ask you too, how do you think reporters can better show the joy that's possible in frontline communities?
Yeah, by showing it. You know? You know what I'm saying, Sarah? I know you can like, you can relate, like, you know, we like, it's like when I was in Jackson, like I was like, there was a water line and like, it didn't get into my story, honestly. And I wish it had, right. I wish we had more space to tell the stories that we do. But people were like joking and hugging each other and telling jokes mm-hmm. and like taking care of each other and smiling, you know. Those are things that we should be depicting, you know, if we want to have like a holistic report. And mm-hmm. maybe there are these times where like we want to say, all we want to say is that people were suffering. But It shouldn't be the whole picture, you know? It shouldn't be the whole picture that people are just suffering, because they aren't. I know from, like, covering these stories enough, and I'm sure you do too, Sarah, especially being in a place down, like, in New Orleans, you know, where people have to hold the realities of, like, great tragedy and great, like, hope and triumph and love, like, at the same time. Like, I mean, I feel like I come from those people, you know? And I was, yeah. I always record it at the very least, like, in my notes, you know, or, like, I ask questions about it. And unfortunately, it doesn't always get into the report. And, you know, that goes to putting it in the story, finding editors to keep it in the story. You know what I'm saying? That's how.
Yeah, I love this question, Sarah. I don't know if y'all got to see Last Week Tonight, but it was focused on transgender rights. And one of the things that ended the report was the importance to talk about the joy of the transgender experience and how it's not always just suffering and sadness and right. And like, it's problematic to allow that to dominate the story. But that also requires us to make room for complicated stories. And it also will require us to not just talk about vulnerable communities, frontline communities, you know, communities in danger when they are at their most acute moments. That's going to require us to stick with these communities. And also, you know, I think showing the joy can probably start to tempt the line with resilience narratives, which we all know is a problematic word. So if it's like, you know, you're showing folks after a hurricane celebrating, you know, celebrating life, you also still have to be able to talk about the horrible thing that they've just had to deal with and the long road ahead of them while also talking about their joy. Because if you end it on the joy while they're still at the acute crisis, I feel like that can send the signal that these folks don't need help. They're good. They got it, right? So that's complicated. And I don't think we do very well with telling complicated stories or reading complicated stories as a society. Yeah, I think we need to do it. I think that there's ways to talk about joy that could become irresponsible, though. So I don't know. What do you think, Sarah?
Yeah, I would say that, like, I know that I've done it right when someone leaves the story pissed off instead of sad. When someone reads a story of mine and they say, oh, that was so sad, I'm like, I did something wrong. You know, that's not what you should be feeling. Like, you should be feeling mad if you feel anything. But because, like, mad is an emotion that you can do something with. But I think sad makes you feel like you can't do anything about it, you know?
Damn.
Yeah. Yeah, that's real. So I know I've told Drew this. I may have told you this story as well, Sarah. But back when I was trying to be a reporter, my short-lived little stint, I did a story about how Hugo Chavez was giving people free oil to heat their homes in the winter in the Bronx. And I met this older woman who told me about how the free oil had, you know, benefited her, cut her costs and all of that. And I was trying so hard to be respectful with my questions to her. And I was completely just taken aback when the photographer who came with me just outright asked her about her breathing machine. Because I was wondering, but I felt like it was so rude to ask her. And she answered. She answered and was not taken aback by that question at all. And like, I was like, my mind was blown. I didn't know you could do that. So how do y'all go about asking sensitive questions respectfully? Like, how do you decide when it's too invasive and when it's not?
Yeah, I mean, I think it's like, there's a lot of sort of context clues sort of thing. I think like it's a case by case basis for me. If it's germane to the story, then I want to try to find a way to ask the question, right? If it's less germane and it's more about detail, then maybe it's something that like I only ask if the vibe is right. It's a very unscientific way of putting it, but that's how I carry it. And then like sometimes like and it depends. It's like different for different people. I just, like, had a couple stories come out about disability and climate change, and...
Oh, yeah, we're going to talk about those.
Oh, okay, I'll just hint a little bit. I just ask people about their disabilities, because I'm around a lot of people with disabilities just in my, like, life, like, otherwise, and, like, also, like, personally having had a physical disability growing up, and, like, when people find out about some of my unseen disabilities, too, I don't want people to, like, be, like, to, like... when I'm asked about it in a way that's like gingerly or like overly sympathetic, it kind of makes me feel like I'm without agency, right? Like I'm like, so I would want somebody to just ask, right? And maybe like a non-judgmental tone, but just ask. And so a lot of times I'll just ask people, you know, or I'll say, if it's like, you know, like if it's something that is more universally being experienced, like a like an acute crisis, like the water crisis, or like aftermath of a hurricane, you could just lead up to it and be like, hey, I might have to ask about some things before you even turn the recorder on. Like, hey, will you be comfortable talking about this stuff? No. Mm-hmm. Okay. What about that stuff? Okay. You know, mm-hmm. sort of
informed consent.
Being transparent about what you're there to do and what, like, how it might fit into the story. And like letting people know what they, especially if they volunteer something that you think might have repercussions for them. Like, I don't think there's any harm in like letting them know, like, or just confirming or temp checking that they're okay with like that being used. So I don't know, like being sensitive, trying to be, and not being entitled. Being curious. Like I think Sarah said earlier, like, you know, not letting that curiosity die out because like you have something in the back of your head that like tells you that this person might not want to share. Mm-hmm. And just sort of trying to hold all those things at the same time.
Yeah. I don't know, Sarah, do you have any thoughts on that?
No, I mean, I think you covered it well. I think it's best, like they're saying that that you just like ask yourself why you're asking this. Why do you need to know? Mm-hmm. You know, mm-hmm. I think that will help you decide whether or not it's a good question to ask.
Yeah. I mean, it's funny because in the case of the story I was just talking about with the breathing machine, I didn't think it was that relevant. But then once I heard, you know, why she had the breathing machine, it was because the air was so polluted in the South Bronx that she developed asthma, and how that related to, you know, her bills and all of those sorts of things. It was like, oh, this actually really does connect. And I was going to be too shy to ask. So anyway, Drew, where do sharks go on vacation?
I got a good one. Martha's Vineyard.
What?
Because that's where Jaws was shot.
That's not a pun, though.
Yeah, that's true. It just went over y'all's heads.
Like, you're just like thinking of nice vacation spots for sharks.
For sharks, yeah, man. The sharks, man. What if the sharks like want to get some vineyard vines, you know?
I mean, I could work with that if it had been Martha's Vineyard.
Ooh,
you know?
That would have been good.
But no, the correct answer is Finland.
Nice. They'll die in Finland, but maybe not because of fucking climate change.
Wait, why? Is it too cold in Finland?
Yeah, Finland's cold, right?
I don't know.
I probably shouldn't just be like a science reporter just like all talking willy-nilly about temperatures. And Finland's like north, and it's like probably cold, and I doubt that sharks can... Anyways, all right. Never mind. There's probably like cold weather sharks or some shit.
Are there cold weather alligators, Sarah? Sarah's a she's kind of low key about it, but she is.
Well, I'm not an but
you can't, like, a science journalist isn't going to be like, yeah, I'm an when they don't have a PhD in alligators, unless you do, Sarah.
I wrote one story about alligators, and Mary keeps calling me an but it's okay.
You've also like swam with them.
That doesn't make you a bro.
I live, yeah, that's true.
Need to be to get in the water with some fucking alligators, as far as I'm concerned. That's not some amateur shit.
I feel like I know enough about them to know not to be too scared of them. But I'll say alligators hibernate. So I think that answers your question, though. They hibernate during, I think, when it's cold.
Hmm. So, Drew, last time you were on the show, we talked about how prison populations are actually frontline communities that often get overlooked. And you recently did this series this week on a group that's also often overlooked, and that would be the disabled community, which you've already alluded to, and how they're often left out of disaster planning. You found out some pretty grim disparities between the countries that signed the Paris Agreement and the countries that signed the Convention of Rights for People with Disabilities. Mm-hmm. Can you tell us a little bit more about that?
Yeah, I don't know the actual numbers because I've been covering a lot of different stories right now, but...
Well, I can help you.
Yeah, please help me with the numbers.
So only 32 of the 192 countries that signed the... Convention on Climate Change, the Paris Accords in 2015, yeah. Only 32 of them refer to people with disabilities in their official climate plans.
Yeah.
45 countries refer to disabled people in their climate adaptation policies, and no country mentions disabled people in its climate mitigation plans.
Yeah.
And a lot of the world's biggest contributors to climate change don't figure people with disabilities into any of those plans at all.
Yeah.
That includes the U.S., China, Russia, Brazil, Germany, Japan, and the U.K.
Yep. Yep. Yeah.
Yep.
Thank you for running that down. Yeah. So it's like, I was pretty shocked by that, actually. Because I don't know, like, mindfulness and planning around people with disabilities seems to be kind of a thing that, like, you would expect of a more technologically advanced or economically advanced country. And that's not the case. Like, some of the poorest, and maybe if we're talking climate, you know, maybe we put our climate hat on when we're thinking about this, you know, some of the poorest countries in the ones that have already experienced, you know, the worst of climate change so far, are the ones that are the first to come up with ideas around climate solutions, you know, and are willing to, like, sign on to some of the more drastic policy measures, you know, and policy commitments. So maybe I shouldn't have been so shocked, but yeah, I mean, and the other thing is that a lot of these countries, minus the U.S., have signed on to the U.N. Convention of Persons with Disabilities, which is actually, like,
right. Pretty
universally adopted at this point, but the U.S. hasn't adopted that. And I think it says something about the country's mindfulness about people with disabilities, you know? We have the ADA, but there's all sorts of problems with enforcement around the ADA, and then also that, like, a lot of times people to bring, like, I think like it's the burden of proof is on the people with disabilities to prove that they, like, need a thing.
Mm-hmm.
If it's not like explicitly, like, in federal policy. Yeah, I mean, there's all these ways that we just don't care about and think about people with disabilities,
yeah,
generally speaking. And so obviously, I guess it gets into the climate planning.
Yeah. And for clarity's sake, ADA is Americans with Disabilities Act.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, I really liked these stories you did, Drew. I thought they were so impactful. In 2021, my best friend, who I co-own my house with, she was hit by a car while riding her bike. And she was in a wheelchair for 3 months. And I... really gave me a glimpse of what trying to navigate New Orleans is like in a wheelchair. We have an elevated house, and most houses, you know, are elevated, and we had to have a ramp built for our house, and we took, like, doors off of our some of our rooms because they didn't allow for her wheelchair to go through. And one of the things I never noticed prior to that, and I'm ashamed to say, but I never noticed that all of the bathrooms at, like, most of the bathrooms at establishments in New Orleans are elevated because the plumbing, like, has to be elevated to not flood. So, like, every time you go to a restaurant or something, you have to, like, go up 3 stairs to go to the bathroom. Mm-hmm. And that also makes it just so hard for folks. And that's before you even get to, you know, dealing with a hurricane or something or an evacuation. So, yeah, it's very important issues, very important issues.
Yeah. Wow. Yeah. Thank you for sharing that. I think, like, yeah, the one thing that I learned from the sources I spoke to so far for this series is, that yes, that their lives are really hard before a disaster strikes, or before, the run up to a disaster, you know, or the aftermath of one, because society doesn't plan for them, you know, in so many different ways. Or And that's not to say that like what you're describing, right, is like is there's it's a well-reasoned thing, like, right, like the bathrooms have to be at a certain elevation. It's just like, so probably there would be need to be some additional planning that goes into having both of those things be true, that the bathrooms can be elevated and it can be accessible, you know. What I've learned from like a lot of the sources that I spoke to for the stories that I hope to keep publishing on this is that society just doesn't really care about them, period. But this is definitely a population that sort of needs to be planned for.
Totally.
And it'll be interesting to see. I mean, I know like at the UN, there's like, you know, we'll see if the UN is completely accessible this year. COP, the UN Climate Change Convention is completely accessible this year. It wasn't last year. And mm-hmm. we'll see what kind of audience the disabled community get and what type of inclusion they get in terms of being part of the policy discussions there.
Yeah, your story mentioned at the last COP, there was, you know, someone using a wheelchair who basically wasn't able to access the convention, right? And that was just last in Scotland?
Yeah, in Glasgow. Yeah, so yeah, Karine El-Harar, Israel's energy minister, like uses a wheelchair, and they didn't want to give her and her people access to the entrance that she could use because she had a wheelchair. There was an entrance, but they wouldn't let her get to it. Because she wasn't cleared or something, and there was the one that they wanted her to use wasn't accessible. So, and this is how it goes. I mean, I have a recording of it. I don't know that I'll report on it because I was actually involved in what happened. But I was at like a sort of just like a public hearing for like federal EJ policy, and it was on Zoom. And during there was a break, and during the break there were some people who were typing things into the chat on Zoom. And there was like a moderator or something, somebody who was like helping out with like whatever agency the meeting was for, that everyone has to say everything that they want to communicate. Like they have to speak it. They can't type it into the chat because it needs to be recordable into the public record. And I was just starting to work on these stories when that happened. And I was like, well, what about people who are mute, who like literally can't speak? Like they just literally can't participate, right? And I mean, they could, you know, they have right. like closed captioning for people who are deaf. But what about people who just can't speak, who might want to participate? So yeah, I mean, this various and sundry, Sarah, write disability climate stories. Everybody who's in the field, write disability and climate stories. Mary, write disability and climate essays. It's a super important story. Everybody, please help. Please help.
No, for sure. Yeah. For sure.
And we've been focusing, or we've been talking about disabilities, physical disabilities, but your story mentions people with cognitive disabilities too, mm-hmm. and how they're neglected in emergency planning. Can you talk about that a little bit?
Yeah, I mean, I think it's not just, and one thing that didn't make it into the story that I'd love to talk about too is that people with like neurodivergence often, they have trouble like being involved in like protests is what like some people were talking to me about and like demonstrations. Because there's just not like this mindfulness of people who have maybe sensory issues or things like that. But yeah, the part that was in the story was just about how like communications about climate change are not mindful of people with like reading disabilities. It's like a very simple way to like think about it. Like there's like an easy mm-hmm. read format, which like when I was writing the sentences that of this paragraph talking about easy read format, I was like, oh my gosh, I'm not even writing in easy read format. Communications yeah. about climate change are not accessible to people who have like either attention deficit or a combination of attention deficit and dyslexia. That's like another way that like we are leaving out a lot of people who like could be part of the solution and who want to be part of the solution. And like at the very minimum, they want to be part of the future, you know, like they want to survive and thrive.
And you know,
they have less of a say in it. You know, I think if you really look at it, because they the solution isn't accessible to them.
Yeah, that was actually one of the things we thought about as we were starting this podcast, Amy and I, about, you know, not everybody learns by reading dense articles. Not everybody, you know, processes information that way the best. Sometimes I don't. Sometimes I'm a better listener than I am reader. And so I think that there's a tendency in the climate community or in the climate conversation to like prioritize that specific kind of intelligence where you're somebody who reads really fast or somebody who processes numbers really fast. And that's not everybody. And we need everybody. Yeah. So why would we do that? So another thing I wanted to talk about is like it's kind of wild how after every major disaster, you kind of only have to wait for the dust to clear a little bit for there to be news about some nursing home scandal, which kind of gets back to what we were talking about before about frontline communities being neglected until they're in an acute crisis. How do you think the journalism community could better serve and include the disabled community on a sustainable long-term basis?
Giving them, giving like hiring them, not just to, and not just to report on disability, putting them in positions of power in journalism, in news outlets and in journalism organizations, by seeing them, making it part of the regular report. It's an incomplete report if it's not concerned with people who are elderly in the community, if it's not concerned with disabled people, just like how, I mean, this, you know, this is the way that it came up for me was, I was like, well, when we talk about environmental and climate justice, a lot of times we talk about class and race in America, at the very least. But what about other communities that are historically marginalized, right? And so the same thing applies here that applies for inclusion of BIPOC voices, of queer voices, and trans voices. And it just has to become part of your everyday existence and mindfulness of it. Like, we can't live our lives with these, like, blinders, which... pun fucking might maybe not intended, and even my language needs to change. With these like with this like sort of like individualistic mindset where we're not in community with a broad array of people, you know, we often, you know, our society is very atomized and we don't live in community with people, or we like are very like narrow about who we're in community with, and we can't. And journalists, you know, if you want to be a record keeper, if you want to be a storyteller, you gotta realize that it's like you're telling like humanity's story. You know, you're not just telling like the suburb story. You're not just telling affluent people's story, or white people's story, right? Or straight cishet people's story, or able-bodied people's story. And that's how you get it into the report, you know, is by it's gotta leave the newsroom with you so that it can come back with you when you come back. And it needs to be in all parts of our lives, you know. That's how, in my opinion.
Snapping over here. Totally. Totally. I agree.
But I do just have one more question. Drew, how do you know if an elephant loves to travel?
The size of its trunk. Give it to me. It was close enough. Okay. Do I get an air horn?
Really? Actually, that's, yeah, I would say that's pretty much it. Yeah, it's because they always pack their own trunk. Because
they pack their own trunk. Damn.
I think you got it. I think that counts as a victory.
No, I don't want that.
Yeah, that's a win. You don't want that one?
I don't want a wall victory.
Wow. I wish I had picked more puns. Absolute victory.
We just stopped talking about living in community. I want an absolute victory now. No, thank you very much.
This is the most Leo reaction to getting a pun slightly wrong.
I'm a double Leo.
Really?
I'm a Leo sun and rising.
Mm. Can you guess what sign Sarah is?
I'm not good at that. Just tell me. I'm not good at that.
Well, one thing you know about Sarah from this interaction is that she stays out there. She's a Pisces.
Mm.
Right? Like, just keep swimming.
Okay. I'm, like, just now learning, like, astrology stuff.
Yeah. And also, Pisces and alligators get along.
Oh, jeez.
That makes you, I think being a Pisces makes you an
Oh,
every Pisces in the world is an
That's it.
New study. I'm going to piss off my editors as much as possible.
I mean, honestly, Sarah, you are the only person I know who has ever said the word alligator gar.
Yeah. Alligator gar.
Alligator what?
A fish. Are you talking about the fish, Mary?
I don't know. It looked like an alligator to me.
No, there's a fish. It's called an alligator gar. They're really huge, and they have lots of teeth.
Cute.
They look like alligators.
Yeah,
kind of. It's hot. So I guess you haven't eaten alligators since you've lived down there, right, Mary? I think we talked about this.
No, I'm vegan.
Right.
I'm not going to eat an alligator.
But have you ever had alligator?
Probably.
Right.
But I don't recall it. Yeah.
I've had alligator. I've also helped a baby alligator out of its egg before.
So you're an alligator midwife?
Yes.
Yes, that's your alligator doula midwife. Come through.
Oh my God.
Birth word is worse.
I need the story. I think we have a couple more minutes. So story.
Well, okay. So I went to this alligator farm when I was in Texas, and they told me while we were at the, the story just caught like completely off the rails, as it would at an alligator farm. One of the things that happened while we were there was a local rancher called the alligator farmer and said that a couple of his cattle had just been electrocuted by some lightning. And he was like, if you come over here and pick up the cattle, you can feed them to your alligator. And so I was like, I need to stick around for that. I'm coming right back after lunch, and I'm going to, like, watch these cattle get fed to alligators. And they were like, yeah, sure, you should do that. And also, you know what else? If you're really into all of it, you could come back when we're hatching our alligators, and you can help us hatch the alligators. And I was like, yep, I am coming back for that as well. So I came back several months later, and I helped them hatch the alligators. The baby alligators, they make these little, like, vocalizations when they're ready to hatch, and at the alligator farms they like help them, because that's what the mother alligators typically do, is they help them like tear their little leather sacks open.
Wow. What's the sound? Can you make the sound?
It's like Hey, that wasn't too bad,
right? And then if you call her an she gets mad. But yeah, ain't no regular ass out here pulling alligators out of eggs, Sarah. Like, that's
I won't just do alligator doula. I do like that, actually. I'll claim that one. Oh, I'll put that on my Twitter profile.
Gator doula.
I spy. Honestly, reptiles are tight.
Honestly, that's amazing. This is a great place to leave it. So thank you so much, Drew, for coming on the show, the third time champion of Hot Take.
Am I the first third timer or no?
You are. You are the first third timer.
Nice. So.
Sarah's going to catch up to you because this is Sarah's second time. And thank you so much, Sarah, for filling in at the last minute.
Thank you. This was so fun.
Hot
Hot Take is a Crooked Media production. It's produced by Ray Peng and mixed and edited by Jordan Cantor. Our music is by Vasilis Fotopoulos. Leo Duran is our senior producer. And our executive producers are Mariana Yves Hegler, Michael Martinez, and me, Amy Westervelt. Special thanks to Sandy Gerard, Ari Schwartz, Kyle Seglin, and Charlotte Landes for production support, and to Amelia Montooth for digital support. You can follow the show on Twitter at RealHotTake, sign up for our newsletter at hottakepod.com, and subscribe to Crooked Media's video channel at youtube.com/crookedmedia.